TD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Thursday, 29th of March already. Cloudy, windy, and seasonal. 40% chance of rain for the morning. Today's high, 49. Right now, some fog in the air, 43 degrees for both Racine and Kenosha, but the wind is calm. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Bird, next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Jack and Drea, featuring Easter candy, new apparel, and garden accessories in its recently remodeled gift shop. Open Monday through Friday from 9 until 6 and Saturday from 9 until 5. For more, visit jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. How is this for a big, complicated question? What is truth? Or maybe another way to think about it is, how many different kinds of truths are there? And what are the ways in which we can both use and misuse truth, or various kinds of truth, for various ends? All of that and more is explored in an endlessly fascinating book called Truth: How the Many Sides to Every Story Shape Our Reality. The author of the book is Hector McDonald, who has consulted with all kinds of different business leaders in various industries, and has been the author of a number of different books, including several different novels. This book is a very, very intriguing look at how we think of truth itself, typically in very simplistic terms, when in fact truth in and of itself is very, very complicated. And by understanding the different kinds of truths that there are, we also can be, in a sense, wiser consumers of truth, and also more effective utilizers of truth in our daily lives, both personally and professionally. I've found the book just incredibly interesting, and I'm happy to have this opportunity to speak with its author, Hector McDonald. The book is published by Little Brown and Company. Hector McDonald, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks very much, Greg. It's great to be here.
I want to ask you briefly about one line in your biography, which says that you are an expert in business storytelling. Can you explain to our listeners what that means, and what connection, if any, that there is between that professional exploit of yours and the topic of this book?
Absolutely. So I began my professional career as a regular strategy consultant, the kind of person that companies invite in to help them decide what they should be doing for the next 5-10 years. But as you mentioned, I've in the meantime been writing a few other books, fiction novels, and I wanted to see if I could combine my interests in writing, in communication, with the business strategy I was doing. And I came across this extraordinary new area of business internal communications around narrative, using story forms to help organizations explain, usually to their own people, what it is they're trying to do and where they're trying to go. So just to give a simple example, a corporation that finds itself in, for example, a difficult competitive environment, or they need to make a big transformation to adopt new technologies or comply with new regulations, or perhaps they've gone through a merger. They need to set out for their thousands and thousands of employees the various strategic reasons why they're making these changes and what they're asking their employees to do differently as a result. And that has traditionally been done through quite sort of hostile and often painful communication processes, we found that turning it into a story, which is not to minimize the seriousness of it, but to turn it into a structure where we proceed from A to B through a logical series of steps that have perhaps an emotional component to them, to, you know, to get people interested in it, is a much more powerful way of engaging often thousands of employees at a time and getting them involved and getting them supportive of the big changes the company needs to make.
So
that's in a nutshell what the kind of storytelling work is I do for companies like DuPont and Pfizer and Barclays. And how that led to the book, well, when you come to write a story for a business of that complexity, you interview all the chief executive and their team, you read endless documents, pour through data, you just are confronted with vast amounts of facts and information about that business, which you then need to distill down to just a few lines, essentially, that make up that simple narrative of what the company is doing, where it's going, and what the people in that organization need to do. And the choice that you make in terms of picking from all those thousands, millions of facts, you know, the 30 or so that you're going to privilege in this story, got me thinking about how one could easily choose a different set of facts and come up with a completely different story that would give a different impression of reality. And that really got me thinking about the flexibility of truth, not only in business, but in many other forms of life, and how it can be used for positive ways like that, but also potentially for very misleading ways as well.
Right. It brings to mind, of course, the way in which you are using the word truth and the fact that your use of the word truth is going to be contrary to those who think of truth as nothing but factual truth, the facts and nothing but the facts. And you tell us that, in fact, it's in a sense more valuable to think of truth in a sense in a little richer and more flexible way. And I'm very intrigued by a couple of the examples that you give of how truth is sometimes beyond just the facts themselves, that can involve elements of, for instance, making a prediction or making a subjective judgment. Give an example for our listeners that will help them understand how truth is sometimes more than just cold, hard, undeniable facts.
That's right. So I spend quite a bit of time looking at fact-based truth in the first part of the book. But then, as you say, go on and look at those statements we make which aren't fact-based, and yet we wouldn't say they're falsehoods or lies. So these are things like moral judgments. It's wrong to kill, I think, is something that many of your listeners would agree is probably true. In almost all cases, we would consider that a truth. But it's not a fact. It's a moral judgment that our society has come to and that I think most of us agree with. Similarly, a lot of the ways in which we use language, for example, are what I call artificial truths. So definitions that we give to words, which of course is incredibly important if you're communicating, because clever communicators can do very dodgy things with the definitions of the words they use. Those are truths that we create as a society, and that they evolve over time, and we can change them if we want to. And a good example of that was Bill Clinton, of course, being very cunning with his definition of the word sex and sexual relations in the Monica Lewinsky affair. Technically speaking, he was speaking the truth, because the definition that his lawyers had managed to get the court to accept of the word sex did not include certain actions that he was admitting to. But of course, most of the rest of the world didn't agree with his version of definition of the word sex. And then you mentioned predictions. Well, a lot of the work I do with businesses is looking into the future, saying, where is this business going? What are they going to achieve? What are they going to try and do? Now, these are not facts, because they haven't happened yet, and yet we act on such predictions as if they are facts, if they're fairly reliable, you know, confident predictions. We invest millions of dollars. We, you know, if it's in our personal lives, we book churches and wedding caterers and buy strollers and baby clothes and all these things based on our predictions of stuff that's about to happen. And if we didn't act on those predictions, then, you know, a lot of things would go wrong, and a lot of important things would go, you know, go unachieved. And yet, of course, we can't call them facts until they happen. So that's why I thought it was important to look at things that we act on as if they're true, but aren't necessarily confirmed factual truths at this stage.
Right. One of my favorite examples in your book is when you say if you were in a crowded building and a building engineer suddenly stood up and said, "This building is about to collapse," you would get out of there as fast as you could. I mean, believing him, giving authority to his words, and treating them as if they are true, when in fact, as you said, there's no way to be absolutely certain. But but for all intents and purposes, that is complete truth being spoken in that moment, and we act upon it as if it is absolutely true, and we're foolish if we don't.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So it's too simplistic to say the only stuff that's true is provable fact, like, you know, the boiling point of water or 2 plus 2 equals 4. These are logical scientific truths, but there's a lot of other truths out there that we accept and use every day, act on every day as if they are completely true, even though they're not fact.
Right. And at one point you say truth comes in many forms. There are competing truths. And you say our choice of truth has so much to do with, first of all, how we influence others, and also the way in which we ourselves are influenced. And then you go on in your book to explore different kinds of truths beyond simple factual truth. And, of course, even factual truth itself can be not a simple thing at all, but beyond factual truth are these other kinds of truths. I want to make sure that we spend plenty of time exploring partial truths, because I think you really help us understand, first of all, how often this happens, how, in fact, just about all of the things that we think of as undeniable factual truths are, in fact, only partial truths. And you give some interesting examples of this, one involving something as simple as an egg, and another involving something as simple as just looking out the window to underscore the complexity of all that is around us. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Okay, so we're coming back to factual truths here, and this is trying to explain that even when we're in the domain of fact, nothing is that straightforward. So if you look out of your window, the chances are that you're going to see maybe some trees out there, but you might also see a line of cars. You might also see some manhole covers in the street. You might see some dogs. Now, different people will notice different aspects of their view. I'm looking out my window right now in London, in England, and the things I'm seeing are things like the skylights on the roofs of the houses opposite me. But what I'm not really noticing is, until I start looking more carefully, is, oh, there's a barbecue on someone's balcony over there, and there's a hose pipe wrapped up over there. If I was interested in drain pipes, I could start to count how many drain pipes I could see. But, of course, you don't see that stuff unless you're looking for it. So different people looking out of this window will see completely different things, and they will have a different impression of their world to me. And I liken this to the old story, which I'm sure many people are familiar with, of the blind man confronting or discovering an elephant. And, of course, the person who touches the trunk of the elephant thinks it's like a pipe, and the person who touches the ear thinks it's like a fan, and the person who touches a leg thinks it's like a tree. This is really how we need to look at fact. It's often so complex, even the simplest things, like the view out of my window, so complex that we only ever get a fleeting glimpse of it, a fragment of the whole truth, as we say.
Right. And, of course, what we're talking about is the idea that this can be done in a sense with the best of intentions, and then sometimes with the worst of intentions. Partial truths can be put forth in which one has been, in a sense, very premeditatively selective in what truths to include and what truths to discard for the sake of making one's point or to convince someone else of your viewpoint.
Exactly. I give one very simple example in the book of a caption that was under the photograph of a former cabinet minister in Britain, in the Times. So it's one of our most respected newspapers, and they had this picture of this very senior politician, and under it said that this individual had supported a particular set of subsidies for biofuels, which were quite controversial and which the whole newspaper's article was against. And it said in the same caption, this man was jailed for, was sent to jail for 6 months in 2013. And the combination of these two facts, both of which were true, implied somehow that he was jailed for his energy policy, for this apparently corrupt thing he was doing with biofuels. But of course he wasn't. He was sent to jail for lying about a speeding offense in his car. They were completely unrelated facts. They were both true, but the newspaper had chosen to put these unrelated facts together in a way that cast, you know, all kinds of prejudice on the energy policy that it was condemning.
Mm. This is as good a time as any to draw in an interesting point you make in the foreword of the book about the three types, or I'm not sure this is the only three, but three important types of communicators that we encounter all of the time: advocates, misinformers, and misleaders. And of course, I think what you're talking about here is three brands of communication in which the manipulation of truth and the careful choice of certain truths is really essential. Can you just quickly spell out the difference between these three?
Sure. And I'm not suggesting that there's some kind of taxonomy that you know, all of us are one of these three. They're more like roles that we may slip into as professional or amateur communicators at any one time. So an advocate is essentially a person who's trying to use selective forms of the truth for positive, constructive means, presenting a relatively accurate, fair portrayal of the whole picture, but, you know, by choosing selective parts of it. A misleader is sort of the opposite. That's the person who is deliberately drawing on partial truths or, you know, selective aspect of the truth in order to give their audience a false impression of reality, in order to mislead us. And in between those two, in between the kind of the saint and the devil, if you like, I had this third category, which I've called misinformer, and that's a really interesting role, because it's a thing that a lot of us are falling into, particularly on social media, where we think we know what's going on, and so we share some piece of news or we communicate something to our friends, which spreads a false impression of reality, but not through our intending to do so. We've just misunderstood the data. We've misunderstood some key messages we've seen. And I give a couple of examples in the book of people doing that. For example, the New York Times, when it reported a few years ago that left-handers are likely to die 9 years younger than right-handers. Now, this is nonsense, and the New York Times almost certainly realized it later on. But they wrote this article based on a piece of statistical analysis done in California in the 90s, which used accurate data but misinterpreted that data to come up with this bizarre conclusion that being left-handed was more dangerous than smoking, effectively. And so no one was deliberately trying to mislead anyone, but they were using true data to misinform people because they had drawn the wrong interpretation from it.
Right. I'm thinking as a very recent example, and I don't know how closely you have followed this story, but the school shooting in Parkland, Florida that occurred several weeks ago,
yes.
On, for
yes.
instance, social media, widely disseminated was a picture purported to show one of the young people speaking out on the issue of gun control, supposedly tearing up a copy of the U.S. Constitution. And that was a falsehood. That was an absolute falsehood. It was a doctored photograph. I suppose that would be a misleader who is trying to convey that. But then you have a whole army of misinformers who are passing on that, what I would call an untruth, not necessarily even fully understanding what they were doing or the kind of choice that they were making in that moment.
And it's a real problem now, with particularly with social media, because we're all publishers, we're all mini publishers, and we're not, you know, we're not kind of gatekeepers. We're just, we're not equipped to assess really professionally the quality and the accuracy of the information we're seeing. We just click like or share or retweet or whatever, and suddenly, you know, that information is passed on again. So all the kind of concerns around Russian meddling in the elections. I'm currently watching the latest season of Homeland, which the plot is all about exactly this, you know, encouraging innocent members of the population to pass on false information. And it's a real problem. It's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is to try and equip individuals, all of us, a little bit more with the tools, if you like, to recognize some of these falsehoods, recognize where the truth we're being served is misleading or inaccurate in some way.
Right.
So that we don't just become innocent propagators of deception, of misinformation.
Right. And at one point you also point out so rightly, I think this applies to just about all of us on the whole range of the political spectrum, on far too many issues we hear only a small proportion of the available competing truths. That is, most of us like to retreat to that sector of the media that speaks the truth with which we are most comfortable, and we need to be hearing a wider span of truths. In the just couple of minutes that remain, I want you to at least be able to sketch for our listeners an idea of what else you also explore in this book, namely the matters of artificial truths, subjective truths, and finally unknown truths.
So let's start with that last one, because we've talked a bit about predictions, but the other category of unknown truths I look at, which I think is really interesting, is beliefs. And again, some people feel a little bit queasy about treating beliefs as truth. But of course, if you talk to the, you know, more than a billion Catholics, most of them will say that the, you know, Scripture is true, that these are truths being handed down by God. And of course, other religions too feel the same way about their holy texts. So I thought it was important in the book to at least treat religious truths, ideological truths, as equivalently important in the way they drive people's behavior, and indeed can be misrepresented and misinterpreted. So we can look at how Al-Qaeda and ISIS, for example, have interpreted the Quran and Islamic teachings in ways that are very different from mainstream Islam, with disastrous consequences for both America and the Middle East. And we can, of course, look at how Christianity has various different versions of the New Testament Gospels, which give different representations of Jesus' life and Jesus' teaching. So I thought that was important to look at. But I think the last category I'd mention is within artificial truths, I also look at names, because I think this is really interesting, the labels and names we give things. And I talk a little bit about things like the Patriot Act and Megan's Law, which are, you know, pieces of legislation that were given such evocative names that however flawed they were, it was almost impossible to vote against them. And indeed, if you look at the voting record on Megan's Law, I believe it was unanimous, unanimously passed in the Senate and the House. It is a bit of a flawed piece of legislation, as has been reported recently in a number of media, but it's very hard to see how anyone could oppose something with a name like that, knowing the story that lies behind it. So names is a really interesting area of creating truth simply by the names and labels we give things.
Ultimately, your book really helps us think about the truths that we take in as consumers, and also about the ways in which we manipulate truth and utilize truth ourselves. What kind of a difference has it made for you yourself personally, having thought about this so thoroughly and now written about it so extensively? Do you find yourself as both a communicator and as a consumer changed in any significant way?
I'm much more aware of the ethical dimension of what I do in my professional job now, having thought quite hard about when it's reasonable to be selective with the truth and when it's reasonable to convey a certain impression that you know may not be the whole truth, which, you know, is a big part of any professional communicator's job. So So the ethical dimension, which I explore a little bit in the book, has really helped me. I think from the on the other side, I hope I'm much less likely to fall for the kind of the misinformation and the misleading that I might have done before. I tell the story in the book about the picture that circulated on Twitter about 3 years ago of the all-male panel at the Women's International Conference, which got so much abuse for this ridiculous, you know, image of this, all these men trying to mansplain to a women's conference. And it was a completely unfair picture. You know, the context was that they had been invited specifically to come to this women's conference to talk from the male, give the men's point of view on how to advance women in business. But, you know, I, like everyone, when I saw that picture, was appalled by it until I saw the context. So I'm now a little bit, I'm a little bit more careful to understand the context and to look at the different sides of the truth before I rush to judgment. Mm. And I hope that the truth, my book, will help people develop similar kind of tools and awareness that I've been learning over the last couple of years. Mm.
The book again is Truth: How the Many Sides to Every Story Shape Our Reality, published by Little Brown and Company, and the author, Hector McDonald. Hector McDonald, thank you so much for writing such a timely and valuable book, and thank you for being part of the morning show today. I have enjoyed this.
Thank you, Greg. It's been really enjoyable.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show Archive. I am very excited about the opportunity to speak with a very, very highly admired author and historian by the name of Nick Bunker, who is responsible for a number of fascinating books, including Making Haste from Babylon, which is one of the best books ever written about the Mayflower and the first years of the Plymouth Colony. His newest book is called An Empire on the Edge: How Britain Came to Fight America. And in it, we have the perspective from the Brits of just what exactly led to the fighting of the Revolutionary War. And that is a story which we Americans almost exclusively think about and view through the prism of our own understanding and perspective as Americans. And Mr. Bunker is a very dispassionate and unbiased observer of history, in a sense, and yet also brings to the table a British perspective, which is so helpful in understanding just what brought the American Revolution about. And so much of it is about Britain and its all but unmanageable empire at the time, and in particular their difficulty and maybe even incompetence when it came to overseeing the vast reach of the North American continent. It's a fascinating story, and this book, now available in paperback from Vintage, a division of Random House, is again called An Empire on the Edge, a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Nick Bunker, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you, Greg. Hello.
I'm so excited to be talking with you. Briefly, I wonder if you would share with our listeners a story which I saw you share in some sort of interview about what prompted your own interest in America. And I believe you credit that, in a sense, to having read some National Geographic issues a long time ago. Just say it's an interesting story. Tell our listeners briefly about that.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's, when I was a very small boy in England, when I used to be taking my mother to the dentist, the dentist surgery was always piled high with old copies of the National Geographic. And this was the 60s, mid-60s, and what he had was a number of copies of National Geographic which dealt with the centennial of the Civil War. And so I would sit there reading these magazines, absolutely fascinated by all these stories about Stonewall Jackson and the various battles, Gettysburg and so forth. And so that really, when I was a small boy, was what prompted my interest in American history. And then, of course, as I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, our television screens were always filled every evening with dramatic events from the United States, whether it be the space program or the Vietnam War, or later, of course, Watergate, which was absolutely fascinating. So really, my interest in American history does go back to that era.
Well, I'm glad it did, because, of course, your book about the Mayflower is so highly regarded, and this latest book is especially fascinating. I think one of the places we should examine with some detail is the state of the British Empire at this point in time, in these years right before the Revolutionary War was fought. At one point in the book, you describe it as an odd and fragile empire that no one had designed and very few people could claim to understand. Explain a little further the way in which the British Empire at this point in time in particular was an odd and fragile empire.
Well, it originated, you see, as a kind of privatized empire back in the 17th century. The Crown of England, although it had been quite keen to see colonies and plantations, both in Ireland but also in America and in the West Indies, never really had the resources to be able to undertake the work of plantation and colonization itself, so that it was kind of farmed out and subcontracted to private enterprise. And the empire, therefore, had a kind of unplanned, slightly kind of inchoate kind of feel to it throughout its first century or so of existence. Now, from time to time, the British would try to introduce a bit of regularity. They would try to introduce some tighter control from the center. And they did this, for example, in the 1680s. And again, they started trying to do it from about the 1740s. But the difficulty was really twofold. First of all, that the British didn't really want to spend money on administration of their empire. They didn't really want to spend resources. And also, they tended to become distracted by other events. At the end of the day, what was going on in Europe, what was going on in the kind of the diplomatic situation in Europe and the machinations of the French and the Prussians and the Austrians and so on, tended to loom far more heavily in their minds than events 3,000 miles away and across the other side of the Atlantic.
At one point you say that part of the problem here was that North America was a continent which she, meaning Britain, did not comprehend and could not hope to rule. And they never had any kind of solid plan for administering the American colonies. I'm just curious, how true was that for other parts of the British Empire? I mean, was it equally true, or was it exceptionally true that North America was, in a sense, this incomprehensible place that the Brits just did not really begin to understand and didn't bother to come to a better understanding of it until it was too late?
Well, if you take the various other elements of the British Empire, really there were two others. The West Indies, the British West Indies, essentially Jamaica, Barbados, Antigua, and so on, and also, of course, the new empire in India and the Far East. Now, the part of the British Empire that was most understood and that was most heavily under control were the sugar colonies in the West Indies. But that, of course, was because though they were relatively small in terms of population and size, they were also exceptionally valuable. Now, the Indian situation was a different one out in Bengal, centered on Calcutta. The situation there was that the British had, in the course of about 20 years prior to the American Revolutionary War, they had managed to acquire this enormous territorial empire, which they hadn't initially expected to do. They had simply been beneficiaries of what was effectively the breakup of the Mughal Empire at that time. So they had found themselves in possession of this vast territory, including what is now the whole of the modern nation of Bangladesh, the whole of the Indian states of West Bengal and Bihar. This is a vast, vast area. And again, you see, it took many, many years. It took perhaps 30, 40 years or so before the British actually worked out a viable way of controlling those territories. It took them until actually into the 19th century. So America wasn't exceptional. The other difficulty in America was, of course, that America effectively did have its own government, or rather it had 13 governments of its own, because each of the colonies had its own little parliament or colonial assembly. And, of course, they really, by the time of the 1770s, were effectively the government for all intents and purposes in those areas.
More so than Britain's government.
Well, yes, really. I mean, most of the day-to-day work of government was actually being done by Americans themselves, particularly in Massachusetts and Rhode Island in New England, where effectively, the colonists were running their own affairs on a town and county basis, so they were used to a kind of habit of autonomy. And the problem really in 1774-5 was that the British, in response to the Boston Tea Party, suddenly tried to take this autonomy of New England away. And well, that was obviously something that was going to lead to severe problems.
It sounds like one of the most serious mistakes which Great Britain made was the way in which they viewed North America. And by the way, I would also be curious to know if, again, this was exceptionally true about North America or if this was equally true of other parts of their empire, but saw it almost entirely in terms of commerce. In fact, at one point, I think you talk about how Britain had, in effect, two overlapping empires, political and commercial, and they were almost completely preoccupied with the commercial aspect and neglected the other, which was a big reason why the situation turned as troubled as it did.
Yes, I mean, in this I actually differ from some other British historians currently. I mean, in the last 20 years or so, there have been a number of British historians who have argued that the British actually did have quite a comprehensive imperial ideology and that they were saw themselves as very much a British empire, Protestant and et cetera. Now, my view is probably a slightly more traditional one, which is that actually essentially it was simply a money-making enterprise. The British weren't really terribly ideological at this period. They weren't really terribly interested in abstract ideas about politics and so on. What they were basically interested in doing was simply having an empire that generated large amounts of wealth for the mother country by way of the flow of tobacco and sugar and so forth back across the North Atlantic and the export of manufactured goods to Americans who couldn't make manufactured goods of their own. So I do see it very much as a commercial empire. And also, the British Empire at the time, in its commercial aspect, was also speculative. Basically, what it was doing was to engage in a lot of speculative trading in commodities, the ones I mentioned, sugar, tobacco, tea coming back from China. And therefore, it was also an empire that's heavily financed by debt, both private sector debt as well as public sector debt, that is to say, debt from private individuals as well as debts owed by the state. And that, of course, again, meant that it was kind of inherently fragile and unstable. You know, sooner or later, there was going to be a situation where a financial or a commercial crisis coincided with a political crisis. And that's essentially what happened in the 1770s. And the British government simply couldn't cope. They didn't really have any way to think through the problems they were dealing with. And they didn't really have any administrative mechanism to sort out the various problems that arose.
How significant was the banking crash, which I believe occurred in 1772, and what were the most important ramifications for that in terms of this period and this situation which your book examines?
Well, it was very severe. I mean, in the 18th century, there were two great financial crises. One was the South Sea Bubble in the early 1720s, and the other one was the crash of 1772, and it came about for the classic reasons. There had been a great big boom in speculation in real estate and commodities and so on, and suddenly it all went horribly wrong in the middle of 1772 when an investment bank in London collapsed. Now, the problem with it was that it caused all sorts of difficulties. It very nearly led to the financial collapse of the East India Company, the body which had all the tea, which ended up in Boston Harbor. It also had knock-on effects in the colonies, too, particularly in Virginia, where many of the colonists, many of the tobacco planters of Virginia, relied very heavily on borrowings that they contracted, in particularly in Scotland. And there was a period of about a year or so when the flow of credit for the tobacco planters of Virginia just dried up totally. And what that meant was that the Virginians began to become more and more disenchanted, so to speak, with the capabilities of the British Empire. I mean, the whole point of the empire really was that it was supposed to enrich everybody on both sides of the Atlantic. And in the 1770s, it was beginning to look as though that just wasn't happening.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Nick Bunker. And he is a British historian responsible for a number of fine books, the latest of which is called An Empire on the Edge, How Britain Came to Fight America, a Pulitzer Prize finalist. It's a fascinating examination of the state of affairs, which in effect led to the American Revolution. But it is a story told through the eyes of Britain by this British historian. Review of your book described it as one of the only books really well written on the fascinating topic of the mechanics of ruling from afar. I love that phrase, and I quite agree with that reviewer that I think this is one of the most interesting things about this story and about your book. Remind us of just the nearly insurmountable challenges that were involved in that time and place to try to rule from afar, and to what extent it could have been done more effectively had, in a sense, different people been in charge or maybe thought in some innovative ways. I mean, how possible would it have been for Britain to effectively govern the North American continent at that point in time?
Well, the obvious problem, the most obvious one, is simply the fact of time and distance, that it took so long for messages to pass back and forth to the Atlantic. But it's important not to overemphasize that, because that had been an issue for a very long time, and there were ways of getting around it. The most logical thing for the British to have done, really, would have been to place a viceroy in New York. They would have had to appoint an official, a high-ranking British official, someone with a lot of talent and a lot of experience, to go over to America and become effectively the viceroy of the colonies overall. That is to say, the king's representative, because then he would have been able to react quickly to developments in the colonies when he saw signs of trouble or signs of issues that needed tackling. And he also would have been able to develop an intelligence network. One of the difficulties the British had was that they were dependent on, for information, very largely on the individual governors of each of the 13 colonies. Now, those 13 governors varied significantly in terms of their talents and in terms of their attitude and in terms of their readiness to actually do some work. Some of them were very diligent, hardworking. Some of them were completely the reverse and rarely sent dispatches back to London. So often there was this kind of great big gap. And the problem of the quality of the colonial governors was really probably one of the three or four top problems that the British faced at the time.
I appreciate the great detail that you with which you describe two of the most important men on the British side in this period, the Prime Minister, Lord North, and then Lord Dartmouth, which in a sense was responsible for the colonies themselves. You describe them in terms that make them sound like, in many ways, quite admirable men, and yet in crucial ways not quite equal to the task that was set before them.
Well, that's right. Now, these two men, Frederick North was the Prime Minister. Lord Dartmouth, actually, his stepbrother, actually, was the colonial secretary. Now, both men in their mid-40s, both highly educated. They'd both been to the same Oxford College, both adept in Latin and Greek and so on. And also, from a private moral point of view, actually, they were paragons of virtue. Both of them were devoted family men. Lord Dartmouth, in particular, was a devout evangelical Christian. He was famous for it at a time when the aristocracy tended not to be the least bit pious, and he was also an early advocate of the abolition of the slave trade. So, and also, Lord North in particular was very hardworking. Lord North was constantly attending debates in Parliament, speaking many hundreds of times during his career, and also something of a master of finance. So they had all kinds of qualities, and they were actually men of integrity by the standards of their time. But the difficulty was really, well, there were several difficulties. One of the problems with Lord North was, first of all, he tended to panic. In a crisis, especially a foreign policy crisis, he would be inclined to take decisions that were too hasty. And he would end up committing himself to a course of action that later he would regret. And that's really what happened after the news of the Tea Party riot in 1774. The British government rushed to take decisions within a matter of weeks when it might have been better to delay for a while, and in particular to gather more intelligence from the other colonies just besides Massachusetts. The other problem with Lord North was that he was immensely loyal to his king, to George III. And once George III had taken the view in 1774 that steps needed to be taken to bring Massachusetts securely back within the fold, then there was really no way that Lord North was going to disagree with the king or to take any independent line. And Lord Dartmouth, on the other hand, well, Dartmouth, as I say, was a very pious evangelical Christian, but he had a kind of a streak of authoritarianism in him. And when he eventually reached the conclusion that the colonists were in rebellion, which was the legal advice he received from the government's law offices, once he'd made that decision that the colonists were in rebellion, then in effect he had to commit himself to a policy of fairly stern retribution.
Your book, of course, chronicles in fascinating detail the Boston Tea Party and helps us understand why that phase of the rebellion took place. And I think probably your background as a former investment banker, you know, equips you to understand sort of the economic complexities of that situation better than maybe some other historians. You probably spend even more time with a much less discussed event. I mean, that is, it's prominently discussed by you, but often Americans don't remember the so-called Gaspé affair, which I think occurred about a year before. Briefly, tell our listeners about this and its significance.
Well, that was in June 1772, and with the Gaspé incident, well, it's very big in Rhode Island, because that's where it happened. The people of Rhode Island certainly remember it. What happened was that the mariners and merchants of Providence, Rhode Island, destroyed a Royal Navy warship in the Providence River, a warship named the Gaspé, which was there to patrol the coast to clamp down on the smuggling trade. And the people of Providence were heavily involved in contraband, and so they destroyed this Royal Navy warship. Now, the reason this is important is really, really twofold. Firstly, because, of course, in London, when the news arrived in Whitehall with Lord North and his colleagues, of course, they were horrified. And it helped to harden their attitude substantially. It meant, really, from that moment forth, there was going to be a significant body of opinion within the British government which regarded the Americans as either rebels already or potential rebels. The other reason it was important was because the British didn't respond to it very cleverly. They kind of dithered. They knew they were very angry about it, but they couldn't think of any mechanism with which to respond. And the mechanism they came up with, trying to catch the perpetrators from Providence, was doomed to failure. It was doomed to failure because, of course, nobody in Providence would get up in court and testify against the men responsible. And so, therefore, all the British did by responding in that way was simply to antagonize people even more in Rhode Island and New England without actually achieving anything. And then that, in due course, also helped to feed into the anger and bitterness in Massachusetts that led to the Tea Party.
Hmm. At one point in the book, you say that the war had been long in the making, the product of an empire and a system deeply flawed, the work of ignorance and prejudice and of men well-meaning, but the prisoners of ideas that were obsolete and empty. I suppose those are cautionary words for just about anybody in any era, that we need to make sure that as we tackle the most pressing problems and issues and challenges of the day, that we aren't doing so in a sense shackled to ideas that have already run their course and aren't equal to the challenge of the moment.
Well, indeed. I mean, those lines you quote are actually in the closing lines of the book. And what you have to be careful of when you make statements like that in a book as a historian is that you're not simply judging with the benefit of 230 years of hindsight. It's important, if one's going to say a thing like that, as I do, that there were people at the time who felt the same way. And indeed, there were. I think the closing paragraph that you're quoted there also includes a quotation from one of them, a man called the Duke of Richmond. Now, the book doesn't really have any heroes, but my favorite character, perhaps, is the Duke of Richmond, Charles Lennox, the Duke of Richmond. He was a member of the British aristocracy. He was an extremely wealthy man, but he was also very outspoken, and he was by far the most outspoken critic on the British side of the government's response. By far the most vocal supporter of the American cause. As I say, he's my favorite character. But it's very important that one can, if one's going to make those kind of statements that you just quoted me making there, that they have some connection with what was actually said at the time, as well as simply being the with hindsight wisdom of someone living two centuries later.
So he says you cannot force a form of government upon a people.
That's right.
And of course, those words prove to be very, very true in this instance. The book, again, is An Empire on the Edge, How Britain Came to Fight America, a vintage book, a division of Random House, now available in paperback, and the author, Nick Bunker. Nick Bunker, a pleasure and honor for me to speak to you today about your fascinating book. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, one of my music colleagues at Carthage College, Dr. Wael Farouk, an amazing pianist, and he has already given many remarkable performances at Carthage, particularly as part of something known as the Brahms Project. Coming up, though, within the next week or two, a performance that is quite remarkable even by his standards, in which in the course of one evening, one single evening, he will perform all 5 piano concertos by Beethoven with orchestra. We'll talk with him tomorrow. Support for the morning show comes from Jack and Drea, featuring Easter candy, new apparel, and garden accessories in its recently remodeled gift shop. Open Monday through Friday, 9 until 6, and Saturday, 9 to 5. More information at jackandrea.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching.